A very, very simple thing, but that's hugely powerful, is to change one three-lettered word for another. What I hear a lot of people saying is, you did this really well, but, and then your mind straight away goes, oh, the negative bit's coming. Again, coming back to teenagers, yeah, that paper was brilliant, but you didn't do that. And that's the only bit that they focus on, ignoring the paper was brilliant. If you change but or and, that paper was brilliant. And next time, if you do this too, and that little change from but to and has a huge impact on how the next bit of that feedback is internalized. It changes it from being something you didn't do to something you can do in the future to get even better. And the energy and motivation that gives someone is fundamentally different.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment and beyond by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Caroline Kavanagh, who's an anxiety specialist, author, professional speaker, and national award-winning therapist. She works both one-on-one as well as with organizations to maintain good mental health within their staff and to help individuals to reduce anxiety and stress and increase mental resilience. She has her own YouTube channel where she uploads content such as stress-busting toolkits as well as shorter tips to reduce anxiety. Welcome, Caroline. Thanks for joining me today.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, let's start by talking a bit about your background. Where did you grow up and what were your early interests?
So I've grown up in the southern half of the UK, a county called Surrey. And I still remember from a very young age, always being fascinated with why do people do what they do? The first book I ever bought as a very young teenager was on body language, because I started to pick up that the way people sit and the way they express themselves through body language was really fascinating. And it's really just escalated from there to, I've had a bit of a varied career in my life, but that real thread of wanting to understand why people do what they do has been something that's come right the way from early years.
It's interesting. It is a source of endless fascination. You'll never be done essentially with wondering about human motivation. And moving to your career journey then, what led you to focus on being a coach, focusing on anxiety in particular?
It's to say, it's been a little bit of a convoluted route. I had a place at university to study psychology, and for a number of reasons, one of them being anxiety, I didn't go. And I drifted into a career in marketing. And a few people have said to me, it's like, oh, that's completely different. But actually, no, because marketing is very much about understanding the psychology with the intention of then selling to someone, either something they want or quite often something they don't know they need. So there is still very much a kind of understanding in there about psychology. And then in my late 20s, I met and ultimately married someone in the army. So having a career became very difficult when you're constantly moving around. And 6 months after we got married, Nick disappeared off to a war zone for 6 months. And so I was stranded in sort of a very remote area with nothing else but a few military people around me. During the week, I was absolutely fine, but weekends were really, really difficult. So anything that came up to occupy my time, I just went, oh, I'll do that. And a friend phoned me up one day and said, oh, I've just booked on an NLP course. And without touching a breath, I just said, NLP, no idea what it is, but I'm coming with you. And NLP, for those that don't know it, it's neuro-linguistic programming, which is sort of offshoots of hypnotherapy. So I went on this course, absolutely loved it. This was like, oh, this is my utopia. This is what I was meant to do. So that really was where I started branching away from marketing. I continued my training in NLP to ultimately become master practitioner. We then got posted out to Germany. So it was quite difficult to work in Germany within quite a close military network because no one wants to work with the boss's wife. And it was then when I came back to the UK that there was things about NLP that are amazing, but a few things that don't sit very comfortable with me. It can be used in quite a manipulative fashion. And the opportunity came around to then train in hypnotherapy. And that's really where I've come to from there. And it's such a wonderful area to be in because there is such a massive growth in neuroscience at the moment. I retrained 12 years ago now. And even in that 12 years, the growth in understanding of things such as epigenetics, that wasn't a word that was around 12 years ago, but now it's quite commonly understood. And I can imagine that this will keep me stimulated for as long as I want to keep on working.
Pretty interesting. My father actually was a psychiatrist, and he had taken a course in hypnotherapy and started to use that in his practice. How would you say some of the roots of hypnotherapy relate to coaching or the work you do with people struggling with mental health or anxiety? What are some of the core principles of hypnotherapy that you think we could all maybe incorporate into our own mental states?
One of the key differences between hypnotherapy and lots of the other talking therapies, such as counseling, psychotherapy, is how the brain is used. So if you imagine you've got two parts of the brain, the frontal lobes here, the above your eyes, that part of the brain is what we call the conscious. It's the part of the brain that's rational, logical, deductive, mature, also has the ability to go out into the past and out into the future. Whereas at the rear part of the brain is the part we tend to call the subconscious. It only works in the now, and it's responsible for controlling all of our emotions. So how our feelings are created is being run by a different part of the brain than the part that we're often working with in terms of our thoughts. So understanding how the brain works and how you can use the front mind and the subconscious part of the brain in symmetry, working together, can actually have a massive impact on how we experience stress.
And let's dig in a bit now to the work you do with people who are experiencing stress. How would you say that the need for this has evolved, particularly after COVID? And you yourself probably have quite a personal experience, given I'm sure many army spouses do struggle with anxiety, particularly when a spouse is being posted in a war zone or somewhere else. And this anxiety you're encountering now with the people you work with, are there common roots to that? Any kind of trends you can observe?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of elements of that question. One of the things that I've seen definitely change, certainly since the pandemic, is a significant increase in anxiety in teenagers and young adults, because it's quite a formative part of one's development is going through the process of examinations, college, early days of university. And for 2-3 years, that was hindered in a lot of teenagers, which has led to a significant rise in anxiety and how that's going to affect them in the longer term. So that's certainly a change that I've been seeing the last 2 years is a massive increase in the need for support of teenagers. One of the most common triggers of anxiety, and I think most people can relate to in some shape or form, is the fear of failure. And that can be triggered in many different ways and at many different scales, but we tend to fear failure and will then the natural instinct is to avoid it. Anxiety is really a word that we use more regularly than fear. And I often make a joke, is fear is a four-lettered F word, and a bit like the other one, it's not socially acceptable. So we've moved to use the word anxiety, but anxiety is ultimately fear. And the fight or flight response is the natural survival instinct that's triggered when we feel vulnerable. Naturally, we will tend to do the flight rather than the fight. So hence, when we are facing risk, the whole survival instinct is saying, well, avoid it, run away. And then it's helping you to use the techniques and the skills that I've learned over the years to say, well, you can actually fight as well, because the other side of overcoming anxiety is growth.
I love that. It's like if you're not winning, you're learning, which is the other yes. The concept of losing. And often everybody will reflect that they learn more from their losses or so-called failures. And it does seem also that ability to, I suppose, live with failure, to embrace failure, not to fear it, seems to come from one's upbringing and the family environment, perhaps, and the expectations there, maybe the family narrative that may have existed around resilience. It's possible that that was more near term when we had the war generation and they had clearly demonstrated resilience, and that would have been in the narrative, perhaps, in the 60s and 70s. It's further away now, so perhaps we're not talking about it as much. But I think you've touched on social media, too, as being maybe a fuel for some of this anxiety, this fear of failure, fear of not measuring up. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen there?
Yes, there's certainly been, it's a contributing factor, I believe, to the exponential growth in teenage anxiety. And a big part of that is a lot of what is on social media is not actually real. So photos have been edited. So especially for girls, but I'm not excluding boys by any extent, the pictures that they're looking at, you know, someone's prettier, got longer legs. Those photos are photoshopped, so they're not even real. But perhaps a more important factor is the frame of reference of the comparisons that we draw. So, for example, when I was at school as a teenager, the people I compared myself, which is a natural human instinct, were real people that I knew. And so that frame of reference is contained, it's controlled. Whereas now, a teenager has access to almost any other individual who has a phone. And so they're comparing themselves to such a huge and diverse plethora of people that it's not surprising that they then see themselves as not being good enough. Because when you're, you know, again, back to my childhood, I could look at someone and say, well, yes, she might be thinner, she might have a nicer skin, but I'm better at this. I can do this. So I can compete on different platforms. But you make that platform almost global and the ability to ever win becomes very, very small.
And this is where your toolkit, I think, is so interesting and your little nuggets, maybe short forms of how you talk to yourself, the words you use. And one I've used with my teenage daughters is the wonderful one you mentioned about judgment versus opinion, how you think you're being judged, but actually that's just someone's opinion. And we will definitely give lower weight, I believe, to an opinion than a judgment. And maybe it won't interfere with our self-worth as much. So can you maybe take us through a few of these tools and maybe a toolkit, just so we can think about maybe ways on a daily basis to start to talk to ourselves differently?
So I've developed a toolkit that's got 30 tools in it. And people sometimes say, oh my goodness, do I need that many? No, absolutely not. But if you think about your wardrobe, you've got a lot of outfits in your wardrobe and you may only use half a dozen of them most of the time, but you've got that lovely dress or that perfect suit for the occasion when you need them. So within the toolbox, it is almost segmented into those, these are for these different occasions. I've got three tools that I call my ABC, and it's like the first aid. So a bit, if you're doing physical first aid, airway, breathing, circulation, those are the three things that you're told if someone's in critical mode. So I have my ABC when your stress levels, your anxiety levels are at that real panic disabling level. And they're very practical, one of them being just how you breathe. Coming back to the fight or flight, when you're in that fight or flight mode, your body is designed to change how it works, and it diverts blood away from your core organs out to the arms and legs to facilitate the fighting or running away. It sharpens all of your senses, which is great if you've got a saber-toothed tiger in front of you, because then that comes to a conclusion very quickly. But if what is triggering that response is nothing more than a thought, then that physical change can become very debilitating quite quickly. You can manually override that by changing how you're breathing. So there is a tip there on how you can very simply change a breath to get back into physiological control. Even something as changing your posture. So people that are down, if they're feeling very depressed, tend to sort of withdraw in on themselves. The head will lower, their shoulders will come round, and that changes how you think. Whereas if you do what I call the superwoman pose, so feet wide, standing tall, head up, again, that changes your access to different types of thoughts. So these are all things that are very, very simple that can take you away from that edge of a high level of anxiety, high stress, to bring you back into another tier. Then there's a range of tools that you can then when you're in a bit more of control to again bring the stress levels down. The third category of tools are things that can stop the stress building up in the first place. So they're more preventatives. And this may be things such as your self-talk. So you mentioned that earlier. I've got four words that within my home here and my children that I tend to correct them on if I hear. And one of them is should. I should do this. The word should is actually externalizing responsibility. I should go for a run. Well, actually, make a decision. Go for a run or don't. and be accountable for that decision. If you want to go for a run, then get your shoes on and get running. If you don't want to go for a run, that's okay. Understand that has an implication too. And as soon as you are taking back control, you feel less anxious. So anxiety and control are two ends of a line of continuum. The more control you're in, the less anxiety you have. The less control, the more anxiety you have. So the more you can take back control, the less the anxiety will be there. And should is a very simple way. Another example being need and must. I need to, I must. Again, it's externalizing the force to do something. Whereas when you replace that with the word choose, you are back in a place of empowerment, a place of control.
It's really interesting because clearly taking control is so key. But yet there also probably has to be an ability to understand the areas where you have no control. And I suppose accepting that and living with it and also living with uncertainty, because that is all around us. And I suppose it's the attempt to maybe banish uncertainty that can actually be a kind of fruitless task. How do you encourage people to live with areas they can't control or areas that will be uncertain?
Yeah, I challenge that a little bit. I appreciate exactly what you're saying. However, the control comes in how you respond to something, because we all live in an environment that's very stressful, but not everyone is stressed because people choose to respond to a stimulus in a different way. So where you might be out of control, for example, let's take the pandemic, something that most people can relate to. You can't control the fact that you were, speaking historically, weren't able to go outside. However, you then can control how you react to that. You can say that's a removal of my human rights. Or you can go, okay, I've been meaning to paint the living room for the last 2 years. I've now got the time to do it. So your ability to choose your response is always something you have an element of control over, if not full control.
I love that. And that's something I use in terms of my counseling of my own teenagers around their mood, in the sense that someone's mood, if it's a down mood or it's depressed mood, it's not necessarily someone else's fault, but there is an ability to choose your response to someone else's behavior.
Absolutely. And I think that's very powerful. And a lot of people find that quite hard to get their head around. He said something really horrible about me. Well, it's just an opinion. That's their thought in that moment. You can choose to laugh it off. You can choose those words to penetrate you and become your reality. But it is a choice.
And all of these tools, at least the ones you've mentioned so far, are all around behavior, psychological state, I suppose, how you, as I mentioned, talk to yourself or just how you frame certain events in life. Is this then at the expense of not using pharmaceutical aids to address this anxiety? Or how do you think about bridging those two or incorporating those as well?
I am not a doctor, therefore I would never say someone had to or had to avoid going on pharmaceuticals. My approach is there to give people, again, choice. You can go down a pharmaceutical route, and for some people that is the right route to go down. Certainly within depression, if your brain isn't creating the dopamine, the serotonin, that is a factor that leads toward depression, then ingesting those to help you lift your mood to then make therapy more effective is a wise decision, in my opinion. Where I become a little bit more challenged is for people that take pharmaceuticals but don't do the remedial work to help them then come off them. And I talk a lot in metaphors, and I'd say to someone, if you broke your leg, you would then do the exercises to mean that you don't need the crutch to walk on anymore. And that's the same. If something is not working effectively in your mind, use the support whilst you heal so that you don't need that support anymore. The support should not become part of the permanent solution if there is no other option.
And it's so interesting because you mentioned earlier the advances in neuroscience. And we have another podcast in our medical series with Professor Veronica O'Keen. She's a psychiatrist and speaks about what they're now learning from neuroscience about, say, the place in the brain that depression may manifest. And it does relate to memory. And the idea that sometimes the rumination can be a feature of depression and maybe over certain memories and not being able to frame them. So some of these tools that you've spoken about, I think, could probably be quite useful, not only in our daily lives, but also in how we frame our memories.
Yes, I mean, the reason we can access memories is because the intensity of emotion attached to them. So I will often joke with new clients and say, what did you have for breakfast on the 18th of May, 2019? And they just look really quizzical and go, what are you talking about? But anything that isn't linked to our survival or doesn't have a strong emotion attached to it, it effectively is just archived. You can never unhave an experience. The memories that we access easily are against those two criteria. They're linked to our survival. So we will all have at some point a memory of touching something hot and burning ourselves. Therefore, that memory is easily accessible because it prevents us putting our hands on something hot again. And that's important to retain those memories as part of that survival instinct. But also anything that has a very strong emotion. So if I said to you, okay, Ethan, tell me about a time when you were really angry or really happy or felt really guilty, you would be able to access those memories because of the intensity of the emotion, not the emotion itself. And this is where therapy can be very, very effective, especially hypnotherapy, because it can start to reduce the intensity of that emotion. So then the memory starts to become archived and is not triggered as regularly.
Really interesting. I'd like to move now to talking about the professional world and how it can be the source of much anxiety, I would imagine, our careers and pressure within them. How well do you think the professional world is appreciating anxiety and how it affects its human capital?
I can really speak within the UK. What I'm seeing is a very positive awareness. There's been a lot of work done, especially within Prince William and the royal family themselves, in raising mental health awareness, especially within men. It's lovely that you touched on earlier the generation around the war, where it's very much about man up. Men don't talk about the feelings. Men don't cry. And that is now starting to change, which is very, very positive. And a lot of work is being done in schools again to facilitate and recognize that it's okay. Any feeling is okay. And you can express that. What I'm seeing more in the commercial world is there is still, within a lot of companies, an element of lip service. So we have a Mental Health Awareness Week coming up very soon, actually, it's in a couple of weeks' time. And I've been contacted by a lot of companies to say, oh, can you do a webinar? Can you do something for us in that week? And my answer is always, yes, I'd love to. And there's a but. As long as there is something that continues beyond that week, I am not prepared to be something that is just a tick box exercise, done our mental health exercise now, we'll stick that in the drawer until it comes around to the third week of May next year. It is only going to be effective when it is part of an ongoing policy to support people that if they are struggling with their mental health, there are things that they can do and it's not deemed to be derogatory or negative to their long-term career.
And I've seen within firms, mental health ambassadors, that role, much more awareness. Those ambassadors will have maybe a sign on their signature saying, you can talk to me, I'm a safe space. Any other techniques that you find particularly helpful to build awareness and ultimately resilience around this?
Yeah, with the companies that I'm starting to work more and more with that really are at the leading edge of taking mental health into part of their culture, is the prevention. Yes, it's great if someone is struggling, help them, but let's start at ground roots and stop the stress building up in the first place. And there's actually some very simple tools that when it becomes indoctrinated within part of that organizational culture. So a very simple example is when you go outside of your comfort zone, a natural instinct is catastrophize. Your brain will go, what if? What if this all goes wrong? And your brain will escalate down a path to its ultimate catastrophizing level. And a very simple technique is flip it. Your subconscious mind doesn't care what question you ask it, it will answer it. So if you ask it a negative question, it will go down to the epitome of a negative answer. Whereas if you flip it and ask it a positive question, it will go down that path just as readily. So something I will again say with all of my clients, if I hear them say, oh, what if? It's, what if it doesn't? What if I don't get that contract? What if you do? And instantly, as soon as they ask themselves that question, you see a change in their body language. You see a change in their energy because their brain has already gone down that path. So if the flip it technique, it becomes part of a culture and any colleague that hears someone else say, oh, what if they go, what if it doesn't? And they flip it. That inherently, that little drip going across the whole organization will have a tidal wave level of change in how people feel.
I love that because it is a tantalizing thought to go down that positive what if,
yes.
And it's almost like a thought experiment. How about feedback? Because similarly, if one tends to hear, I know there's a statistic even about where negative feedback can be amplified often in our brains and positive feedback minimized, and the same with wins and losses in life. How do you think about the dose of feedback, how much to give, and the practice of it?
Again, a very, very simple thing, but that's hugely powerful, is to change one three-lettered word for another. What I hear a lot of people saying is, you did this really well, but, and then your mind straight away goes, oh, the negative bit's coming. Again, coming back to teenagers, yeah, that paper was brilliant, but you didn't do that. And that's the only bit that they focus on, ignoring the paper was brilliant. If you change but or and, that paper was brilliant. And next time, if you do this too, and that little change from but to and has a huge impact on how the next bit of that feedback is internalized. It changes it from being something you didn't do to something you can do in the future to get even better. And the energy and motivation that gives someone is fundamentally different.
It's just so, it's an additive. Is that one of your tools in your toolkit?
Actually, it's not, but maybe it will be. I'll have 31.
Because I've heard about it, and I was wondering if I'd heard it from you, but I've definitely heard that. And I catch myself now every time I say but, because I realize that it minimizes what's just gone before. So I think that that is a kind of a fundamental just language, and getting back to your original training of that course you ended up in, language matters. Clearly, that's coursing through this. We'd love to go back now just to a few personal reflections. So over the course of your career, were there any particular, we talk about building resilience here and setbacks and how we can learn from them. Were there any notable ones of your own that you learned lessons from?
Yes, I think the most important one for me is twice I ended up in hospital because I became so stressed that I actually became very critically ill. And there was nothing physiologically wrong with me. I'd actually got to the end of that point where my brain was saying, if you don't stop, I will stop you. And it didn't just happen once, it happened again. And it's not going to happen a third time. And I think that really was a fundamental change for me to say, I need to change something in my life, how I'm approaching things. And that really was the impetus to start learning about the self-development. What can I change? How can I start internalizing things, making changes in my behavior, to then mean I never get to that point where my mind has to shut my body down because my thoughts are overriding my body saying I'm too tired.
It's so interesting, isn't it? We can't separate our physical and our mental health. I mean, there's so much, just so you mentioned the neuroscience research, so much research now on the effect of cortisol and how that can shorten lives and it can cause far worse health outcomes. And we have to be real to this. And that's why that professional integration of this awareness is just so important. Given that you are in the business of giving advice, and I'm sure you've heard also much advice from the professionals that you encounter in your circles or elsewhere throughout your life, is there any creed or motto that you live by or any additional nugget of advice that you can leave us with?
Yeah, I think that there's two. And again, I use them at different times. When I have my down moods, and let's face it, we all do, the one that is my go-to is, this too shall pass. Nothing lasts forever. So I lost someone very close to me just a couple of weeks ago. And even in that depths of grief, I was like, this too shall pass. And that doesn't mean I don't miss that person now, but by repeating that saying, the pain is less and I can look forward much more easily because the brain needs hope. And as long as there is a glimmer of hope, you can move forward. That's the one that I go to when I'm in, shall we say, a darker place. What I love to do when I'm in that buoyant mood is just say yes. Whatever it is, just say yes. Because as we almost brings us full circle, even if it doesn't work out the way you thought to, there's learning. And every time you do something new, you're learning, you're growing. I take so much from nature. I spend a lot of time outdoors. And one of the fundamental principles that someone once said to me about nature is everything in nature is either growing or dying. Now, that's a little bit, well, it's very black and white, but actually it's relatively true. And so the more you can grow by doing something new, the more you're just evolving. And that for me is a really important thing. I'd rather be growing than the opposite.
Well, thank you so much, Caroline. This has been a wonderful coaching session for me. I feel it's been restorative in many ways. It's so important to think about the language we use, the way we frame our experiences, and ultimately to be, I think, set for seeing the positive and seeing the wonderful opportunities that being positive can bestow. So thank you for coming here and sharing your story and your insights with us.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
I'm Aoife Devitt. Thank you for listening to our 50 Faces Focus series. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring professionals and their stories, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.